You're listening to Wikisleep Podcast, a podcast designed to help you relax and unwind through calm, quiet storytelling. I'm your host, Adrian Sala. Today's episode is on wine, a big, complicated subject that people spend their entire lives learning and exploring. Wine is loaded with tradition, nuance, strange history, and all sorts of rules that go against the rules of the rules that you should always follow. And that makes people nervous. But really, who cares? It's just wine. Knowing a bit about it is great, but remember, the most important thing about a glass of wine is that you have one in front of you. In a way, the history of wine is the history of civilization, intertwined with religion. Because of the deliciously altered state it so graciously puts people in, wine, or wine-like beverages, have long been thought of as sacred liquids by most major religious organizations. One of the most common uses is with the Christian ceremony of the Eucharist, also known as communion, where devotees consume crackers and wine to represent the body and blood of Christ. There is also a story about Noah from the Bible, who famously passed out and drunkenly exposed himself to his sons after too much of the good stuff. But it isn't just Christians who dig on wine. In Greek mythology, Dionysus, the son of the god Zeus and a mortal woman named Semele, was promoted to full god status after discovering how to harvest grapes and produce wine, which seems a pretty good reason for being vaulted. And it isn't the only incident of ascension or salvation for someone who did the same. In a Persian tale, the grumpy king Jamshid banished a member of his harem, who became so distraught she decided to end her life by drinking grape juice that had gone off and was believed to be poison. But to the pleasure of both the girl and the king, her attempt did not kill her, but made her drunk and happy instead. Because of her accidental discovery, she was forgiven and reinstated into the harem. Jamshid then decreed that all grapes of Persepolis were to be devoted to creating wine, and essentially became one of the world's first wine geeks and a major trader of wine during the Persian Empire. There's also a tale of the ridiculously wealthy Egyptian pharaoh, Cleopatra, promising her lover, Roman general Antony, that she would drink the value of a province for him. At which point, she dropped a very pricey pearl into a glass of wine and drank it back. No one is exactly sure how the gesture was received, but it's worth noting that Cleopatra was the last active pharaoh of the Egyptian Empire. Sometimes having too much money makes people stupid. All the various lore and myth stuff aside, the practice of fermenting grape juice, also known as winemaking, is incredibly old. It predates written history, but there is a lot of evidence that it was being done well before the Egyptians were putting up giant pointed sandcastles to bury their earthly gods. A recently discovered stash of wine was found at a Neolithic village site in Iran. After analyzing one of the 6 clay vessels, it was determined by scientists to contain the remnants of 7,000-year-old wine. This proves that you may as well always drink what's left, otherwise you might die and your wine could be forgotten for thousands of years and no one will be able to thank you for sharing. While there were pockets of people making wine in the Middle East thousands of years ago, it was the Romans and Greeks who really took things to the next level and secured wine as a major part of life for everyone around the year 100. The Romans are credited with constructing the first efficient wooden barrels for storing large amounts of wine, and the Greeks adapted the then recent invention of the screw to create the wine press, which allowed for mass production of a product that was previously made using a slow and laborious process. It's also worth noting that the first printing press was made from a modified wine press. Gutenberg knew there was something compelling about wine and managed to change the world with its most useful tool. Together, the Greeks and Romans helped turn wine into a commodity. By the end of the first century, there are written accounts of soldiers and citizens being publicly drunk to the point of it being viewed as a social issue. Later, due to links between religious ceremony and the rise of Christianity throughout the Roman Empire, wine became an essential part of daily life. And by the time the Renaissance kicked off, wine was the drink of most social classes in mainland Europe. There were a number of additional things that happened to increase wine's popularity over the years. Its relative rarity in northern regions, such as England, made it a luxury that people with money wanted, and that in turn led to developments in storage and shipping. By the time the world really opened up in the mid-1600s, people and pirates were trading goods across oceans, and the demand for wine exploded. Spanish conquistadors brought wine to North America and established vineyards in modern-day Mexico to support religious ceremonies. Interestingly, in the 17th century, Mexico, then known as New Spain, became such a dominant producer of wine that colonists living in the New World stopped purchasing Spanish wine. This diminished Spanish exports, hurting the bottom line of the Spanish monarchy. In order to get some of his cash back, Charles II of Spain decreed that all Mexican vines were to be pulled from the ground, except for a few that were dedicated to making wine for specific religious practices. And just like that, Mexico went from being a major producer of wine in the New World to virtually non-existent, and it hasn't ever really recovered. For better or worse, as more Europeans moved about the globe, they brought with them the techniques and grapes required for winemaking, and wine became an international interest and business in countries all over the world. Today, wine is produced and consumed at almost unimaginable rates. It is estimated that over 25 billion liters are consumed worldwide every year. What's great is that all that consumption and production has leveled the playing field. Because there are so many regions producing such interesting and delicious wine, it's easier to find inexpensive bottles that are very drinkable. Of course, there are still pricey bottles that people geek out on, which is totally okay. The process for making wine has remained more or less the same since forever. Of course, there have been some minor refinements, discoveries in the winemaking process that have led to more consistent and higher quality wine. But fundamentally, it's the same process the Greeks and Romans used a couple millennia ago. You're drinking the same stuff they did. Save a bit of clay and muck in the wine. Everything needed to make wine exists in the grape itself. Juice, sugar, pulp, tannins, and acid. At the end of the day, it's really as simple as squishing grapes, letting the juice ferment, and putting it in bottles. But of course, it's also much more complicated than just that. The first step is to grow the grapes. Good grape growing is key to making great wine, which is why you'll hear a lot about terroir, otherwise known as the dirt and climate the grapes are grown in. There's a boatload of stuff that actually goes into growing grapes, but fundamentally, it's sunshine, water, and some good farming. Step two is to harvest the grapes. Knowing exactly when to harvest grapes is a skill which is connected in large part to a farmer's intuition and experience. Bad grapes are culled and the good grapes are kept and moved on to the next step, which is to crush the grapes. The point with crushing is to break the skin, not necessarily squeeze out all the juice. Once broken, the yeast on the skin begins to mingle with the juice, initiating the process that will eventually result in alcohol. For white wine, the skins are then typically removed from the juice, and for red wine, they're kept on. The fourth step in the process is to ferment the grapes. Fermentation is the process of converting naturally occurring sugars into alcohol. The juice is typically put into giant steel vats to ferment, but it's sometimes also put directly into wood barrels or large cement vats where the process happens. Then, winemakers rack the wine. Racking is the process of moving wine that has been fermenting in larger vats into fresh barrels. It's also the chance for winemakers to clarify the wine by filtering it as it transfers. Then, winemakers wait as the wine ages, and once aging has been sufficiently achieved, they move the wine into bottles where it continues to age until it is opened. Before it's sold, the wine is stored in a cool cellar, a room that is free from sunlight, which can affect wine over time. The final step, after shipping and purchasing, is to drink the wine. Put it in a glass of some sort, lift it to your mouth, and pour some into your word hole. The vocabulary around wine is astoundingly verbose, and there's a huge amount of wine speak that is just unnecessary. That said, there are terms in wine that will turn up no matter what, so it's good to be at least aware of what they mean. Acidity refers to the tartness or crispness of a wine. Think of citrus fruits, like lemons, limes, or grapefruit. Aroma is the way a wine smells. Some wines have richer aroma than others, while some are a lot more soft or subtle. Things like alcohol content and the grape variety influence the aroma a lot. Balanced refers to the four main elements in wine: tannins, fruit, alcohol, and acidity. A well-balanced wine means that none of these qualities overpowers any of the others. The blend is the mix of different grape varieties in one bottle. Body is the weight or feel of a wine. In the same way that a glass of water and a glass of milk have a different body or feel, so too does wine. Character simply refers to the attributes of a wine and is completely in the hands of the person describing it. Corked is the term used when the cork in a bottle has allowed air into the wine or gone a little rotten itself, meaning the wine usually takes on a flavor of wet cardboard. Dry refers to a wine that is opposite of sweet. And finish are the final flavors that linger on your tongue after you've taken a sip. If the flavor drops off fast, it is considered short. If it lingers, the wine has a long finish. Legs, also known as tears, appear as drips on the inside of a glass after you swish it around. Off simply means no good or not right. The wine could be corked or oxidized. Palate is your ability to taste and distinguish different characteristics in wine. Plonk refers to wine that is neither expensive nor special, but still drinkable. You should never be concerned about opening a bottle of Plonk and should always have a few bottles lying around, just in case. Sediment is the dusty-looking stuff in red wine that collects at the bottom of a bottle and sometimes winds up in your glass. It's a completely natural substance that comes from wine not being over-filtered and is essentially just grape skins, pulp, and a bit of yeast. And it's all very harmless. A sommelier is a person who has studied wine extensively and taken tests to prove it. Not many people are sommeliers, although a lot of people think they are. Terroir is the land and farm, the soil and sun and climate, where the wine was made. Variety is literally the type of grape, such as Sauvignon Blanc or Syrah. Vintage refers to the year that the grapes were harvested and fermented to become wine. And a vintner is a winemaker. Grapes and wine that come from colonized regions like North and South America, Australia, and South Africa are still known as New World wines. And some people continue to think this makes them of a lesser quality, which is completely false. New World wines have been evolving for hundreds of years, and they are some of the best in the world. When it comes to wine with bubbles in it, all champagne is sparkling wine, but not all sparkling wine is champagne. In order to be called champagne, sparkling wine must come from the Champagne region of northern France. Everything else is just bubbles, but that doesn't mean the process, variety of grapes being used, and outcome are not often exactly the same. The designation is a legal thing the longtime winemakers from Champagne wanted in order to preserve their livelihoods. Sparkling wine has a long and rich history. Famously, Dom Pérignon, one of the most prestigious champagnes on the planet, is named after a Benedictine monk who made several significant improvements to the process of bubble production. It was also once known as the Devil's Wine because it was prone to exploding and setting off a chain reaction where one bottle rupturing could wipe out an entire cellar, like an explosion at a fireworks factory. And because it was prone to exploding, no one wanted to make it. But after the introduction of thicker bottles and cages around the cork, its popularity rose quickly. Production of sparkling wine went from around 300,000 bottles a year in 1800 to over 20 million by 1850. One of the most famous champagnes in the world is Veuve Clicquot, and what you need to know about that is that Veuve is the French word for widow. After inheriting the business and vineyard at the age of 27 in 1805, Madame Clicquot turned her brilliance to making champagne. She quickly established new techniques of production that would make the Clico brand one of the richest in the world. In doing so, the widow Clico made her way into royal courts all over Europe during the Napoleonic era and eventually received a royal warrant for her product. Today, Clico is one of the most recognized brands in the world. Sparkling wine also comes by many names. In Spain, it's known as cava. In Italy, it's spumante and espumante in Portugal. Austrian, German, Czech, and Slovak sparkling wines are known as sekt. While in South Africa, it goes by cap classique. In North America, it's mostly just known as sparkling wine, although some winemakers go with Brut, which is typically a dryish sparkling. Other red sparkling wines, such as the popular Lambrusco from Italy, the bulk of them are white, with some rosé bubbles available too. The first few steps to making sparkling wine are identical to standard winemaking. The difference being that after its initial fermentation, sparkling wine goes through a second fermentation inside its bottle, aided by a process known as traditional method, or méthode champenoise. At the beginning of the second fermentation, winemakers will add a small amount of yeast and sugar to help increase the bubble factor. The bottle is then capped with what looks like a beer bottle cap and set in a rack with its neck tilted slightly toward the floor. Over the next several years, winemakers gently tap and turn the balls, gradually leaning them so the neck is pointed straight toward the floor. The point of doing this is to tap all the yeast and sugar, known as lees, into the neck. The final step is to cork and cage it, but before that can happen, winemakers go through a process called rumage, which is French for riddling. In this process, winemakers freeze the neck of the champagne bottle, which turns the lees into a hard slush that pushes out of the bottle when it is turned upright and the cap is removed. When this happens, corks are quickly plunged into the bottle and then caged with a wire case called a muselette. And voila, you have champagne or sparkling wine. It's worth noting that undoing a muselette cage on any bottle of sparkling takes exactly 6 half turns. Most people think that wine that comes from a box is of poor quality. That's not entirely wrong, as a lot of bad wine does come from a box, but it's also not totally right either. The thing about it is that a box of wine is actually a bag of wine wrapped up in a box, and winemakers often put the exact same wine in the bag as they do in the bottle. And often, the reason it's less expensive, and so perceived as less quality, comes down to packaging costs. Top-end producers typically won't box wine, but a lot of mid-range ones will, especially in Australia, where a box of wine is sometimes affectionately known as a goon bag and is incredibly popular. Australians drink more boxed wine per capita than anywhere else in the world. You may notice that French wine doesn't always tell you what's in the bottle, and instead just tells you where it's from. That's because the European wine system is very old. Old enough that when it was created, certain grapes only grew in certain regions, so the regions became the namesakes. Even the novice wine drinker in the 17th century probably understood that Chardonnay grapes were mostly grown in the Burgundy Chablis region. Also, not all fermented grape juice is left to become wine. Some of it, a lot of it actually, gets a bolt of brandy or some other spirit added to it, and is transformed into a fortified wine. The practice of fortifying wine is an old one, at least over 1,000 years, and was used to help preserve wine for shipping or storage, since adding spirits can help it last almost indefinitely. The Douro Valley is one of the oldest wine regions on Earth and was officially made a protected appellation in 1756. Port's popularity grew in England during its long wars with France, since the French made it hard for Englishmen to get their hands on French wine. The English dropped the import tax on port in 1703, and it quickly became the drink of choice. When pairing wine, it's important to remember that there aren't any rules you have to follow. The best glass of wine for you is the one you want. However, there are some variables to consider when pairing wine with food, but the principal idea is that you don't want the food to overpower the wine, or vice versa. They are meant to complement each other. For example, if you're eating something spicy, you probably don't want to drink a subtle wine. You'd do better to go for something sweet like a Riesling, or spicy like a Syrah. Also, a nice rule of thumb is, if what you're eating gives milk, go with red. If it swims or flies, go with white. If it's cheese, go with whatever you like. At the end of the day, wine is about history, fun, and enjoying it with the people you care about. So drink whatever you like.